can continue. We have so far, we have only really looked at the first of the four noble truths in many ways, and in some ways perhaps the most important one to understand the problem that we are in, because once you understand the problem, you kind of get the motivation to do something about it. But all the four noble truths are kind of right to use, they're all about right to use in a certain sense. It's a way of looking at the world, a way of understanding the world, which according to Buddhism accords with how the world actually is. So now I want to move on to the second noble truth, the first one being the problem, the second one being the cause of the problem. It's like a medical diagnosis, that's what you are doctors, you know, something like this. So you have the problem, the illness, then you find the cause, like you make a diagnosis, and then because there is a cause, well, then you can presumably cure it, and so you find a solution, and then you have the medicine, and the medicine, of course, is the noble eightfold path. So what is the cause? This is the second thing here. So we go back to page one. Yeah, so please don't despair, we will make progress slowly, but we have to go back to page one and just briefly. And this then is the noble truth of the origin or the cause of suffering. Now this is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It's the craving that leads to future rebirth, mixed up with relishing and greed, taking pleasure in the various realms. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for continued existence, and craving to end existence. Yeah, so this is the cause of suffering. And one of the interesting things that very often, or very sometimes when people talk about craving being the cause of suffering, they say that, well, it is the cause of suffering because when you crave, you are suffering. And when you crave, you are not united with what you like, but like a distance between you and where you want to be. Yeah, so they say craving, and when you crave, you suffer. That's why craving is the cause of suffering. But actually, no, that is correct. Because if you suffer when you crave, that means that craving is a suffering. It doesn't mean that it causes suffering. These are two different things. So craving, if craving is suffering, it belongs to the first noble truth. And if you go to the first noble truth, it actually says specifically that being separated from what you like, yeah, not getting what you want, this is suffering. In that sense, craving is actually suffering. When you crave, you suffer because you're separated from where you want to be. You're not where you would like to be. So that cannot be what it means. It can't mean that. It must mean something else, that craving is the cause of suffering. It doesn't mean that it actually is suffering in its own right. So what does it mean then? And what it means, you get the idea straight away here. It says that it is the craving that leads to rebirth, which is the cause of suffering. Yeah? In other words, it is the fact that it kind of carries you on in samsaric existence, from life to life. That is the actual cause. Because as we have seen before, and this is one of the things that you see in the Four Noble Truths, all the way through them, rebirth is the problem. Because that is what drives you on endlessly in this decade. If there only was one life, it wouldn't be such a big deal. But because it goes on forever, that is where the problem arises. So the craving here actually refers to the thing which drives you on in samsaric existence. That is the problem. It leads to rebirth. And this is such an important point. And in these days, you have met some Buddhists who don't really believe in rebirth because they reckon rebirth is some kind of ancient superstition. Right? Or maybe not. Maybe rebirth is not just an ancient superstition. Maybe there's some truth to it. Maybe we should sometimes need to have an open mind to some of these ancient things. Because just because people were ancient doesn't mean they were stupid. Sometimes we think that we are much smarter these days than people were 2,500 years ago. But in many ways, the Buddha was probably one of the smartest people in history. Yeah? So sometimes you go back in history and you find people who were incredibly wise, incredibly smart, very sharp with it, and they really had a profound understanding of reality. They didn't have the same science, the same technologies. We think that they were more stupid, but that has nothing to do with your inner capacity for understanding. So we have to be, it's easy to get conceited sometimes. Yeah? You think you live in an advanced society here. But actually, usually, humility is a much better quality than being conceited here, because it opens you up to new possibilities. So, the craving that leads to rebirth, porno, babika, tanha, porno is again, from puna, puna is again, baba is existence. So it literally means the again existence craving. Yeah? That is what it refers to there. Yeah? Mixed up with relishing and greed, manti raga sa'agata, these are just alternative ways of thinking about craving. Manti, delighting in things, relishing things. Raga is desire, it's not the word for desire. All these words point to desire of various types. Taking pleasure in various different realms. Tatra binandini. Abinandini is also to delight. Tatra means here and there. But the Sujata translates different realms, or it could just mean delighting various things of this existence. This is the thing, it's like the world, there's endless delights in the world. Yeah, there's endless kind of things you can go after. Yeah, there's endless possible relationships you can have. Because there's 7 billion people, there's quite a few relationships you can have on this planet. There's endless kind of places you can go, yeah? And you travel around the world, and when you focus in on something, there's kind of always more places you can see. Even Hong Kong, I've been to Hong Kong 5 times, and I've seen almost nothing of Hong Kong. I've seen the Kadoorie Center, and I've been to kind of Victoria Peak once or twice, and I've been to a couple of the other hotels as well. That's pretty much what I know of Hong Kong. But then when I look out my window, I see these beautiful hills everywhere, and I see the little paths, and I say to Gerald, I said, oh, look at those paths over there, yeah. And and then you kind of want to go for a walk on this path because it looks so beautiful. Yeah, so just even knowing Hong Kong, it takes a long time because there's so many different bits and pieces, let alone the whole world. And there's all the different foods. You can travel here, eat this kind of food, that kind of food, yeah. And so there's endless relishing here. Until one day you realize that it is all pretty much the same. There isn't that much difference. Yeah, so what? If you travel to Hong Kong, or you travel to Europe, or you travel to Japan, or to Africa, or whatever, it is a bit different, but it's all roughly the same. It's just variations of the same theme. This is one of those beautiful things that was said by one of these famous Thai Ajahn teachers in Thailand. He said, well, you travel around the world, it's just the same, basically. It's just kind of slight variations of the same thing. And yet people are so keen on traveling around. When we go to our monastery, I always like to say, I probably said this many times before, but such a nice thing when Ajahn Brahm said, yeah, you know, you want to travel around, you want to go and see the Great Wall of China or something. Instead of going to see the Great Wall of China, go to the edge of the monastery, look at the monastery wall. That's good enough. Yeah? Same thing as the Great Wall of China. Okay, a bit more humble, but same principle. Yeah? It's just the wall. One wall is big, another one is small, one wall is fancy, another one is simple. Still, it's just a wall. It's built out of rocks, you know, and, okay, the Great Wall of China, I admit, is more impressive. But still, the same principle applies there. So after a while, you kind of think, okay, what's the big deal? Yeah? And then you look for something more profound instead. But this is the traffic of the world. Tantra, tantra, binandini. Always delighting in something else. Moving on to something new. Thinking there's something to be had in this world, but never really being satisfied, never really coming to any true contentment, because these things are endless. They go on and on and on. And you keep having doing this, we've all been doing this for long enough already. So this is kind of the outlook, the Buddhist outlook. And the reason why this outlook is interesting is not because it's supposed to just to turn you off the world, but of course it points to something better, something more profound, a greater kind of contentment and happiness. That is the point of this. The point is not just to make people depressed. That would be pretty bad, wouldn't it? So that's not the point, of course. The point is to actually discover something more profound, more fulfilling, more that fills you up fully and completely for the first time. Something that really makes you feel, wow, now I found something really meaningful. Instead of always searching, instead of always running here and there, you actually do find the thing and then gives you that fine sense, deep sense of meaning inside it. And that is what samadhi does, deep meditation. And then based on that samadhi, not only does it give you a sense of meaning, it also takes you to insight and understanding of reality at the same time. Yeah, it's win-win before this. Win-win, maybe. Yeah. You win in all possible ways. So this is the Buddhist idea of the cause of suffering, craving that leads to rebirth. Why does craving lead to rebirth? And as I mentioned the other day, the reason is because craving is always about the future. So when you crave, it is as if you are already in the future. You're already, your mind is not really in the present. You're already heading towards the future somehow. You're driving yourself onwards. Every time you desire something, every time you crave something, you're already on your way somewhere else in the future. And the will kicks in. Yeah, the driver inside kicks in. And then you're on your way. As long as that engine is there, that engine just drives you forward, consciousness, the mind, cannot stop, and it will drive on into the future. The moment craving stops completely, you have stopped that propelling yourself into the future. Everything comes to an end, yeah? And then when you die, it kind of just comes down, and it comes to an end instead. That is why, when there's no craving, things just stop. This is an insight, yeah? It may seem a bit strange to you, maybe it's hard to relate to, maybe you can relate to it a little bit, but not fully. So that's why this is called an insight. You see this driving force. This is part of the insight of becoming a stream enter. So this, the interesting thing about this is that the idea of craving, driving rebirth is actually the core of what dependent origination is all about. I just asked Gerald a second ago whether I have taught dependent origination here in Hong Kong before, and he said no, and I also cannot remember having taught it here, although after a while you get a bit confused because you know, when you teach in many places, I don't know how to remember it. So I thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about dependent origination. And the reason is because the second noble truth that we have been looking at now is really just a contracted version of dependent origination. There is a sutta specifically that talks about the second noble truth. It says that it can be understood in terms of dependent origination. Why is that? Well, the reason is because in dependent origination, it ends with the dukkha, and in the middle there, you have craving. Tanha is in the middle of dependent origination, so it shows you how tanha gives rise to dukkha via rebirth. But dependent origination is broader, it takes into account other factors. So there's a deeper explanation for what is going on. That is why it is sort of interesting. Yeah. So are you interested in dependent origination? Yeah? Okay, good. And sometimes people think it's scary. Dependent origination is scary, it's very hard to understand. But actually, the basic mechanism is not so hard to understand. Yeah? And it also has practical implication. It's not just theory. It's not just pure, intellectual, castles in the air. It actually has some real practical purposes as well, which is great. So that reason, I want to look at that now. So now we can move forward a bit again. So if you move forward to two pages forward, you have, just after we left off yesterday, we have the sutta called Dependent Origination, SN12.1. SN again is the Sanyutta Nikaya, Connected Discourses of the Buddha. 12 is a 12th chapter, and this is all about dependent origination. A whole chapter about dependent origination called the Nidana Sanyutta, the Connected Discourses on Source or Cause, Causality. And this is the very first sutta in this collection. So I will read it out, and this is probably a standard, this is a standard formula that you, many of you will probably have heard before. And now we're going to delve into it in a bit more detail and see what it is all about. So I have heard, at one time the Buddha was staying in Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, another Pindika's monastery. There the Buddha addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, venerable sir, they replied. The Buddha said this, mendicants, I will teach you dependent origination, paticca samuppada. Listen and pay close attention I will speak. Yes, sir, they replied, and the Buddha said this. What is dependent origination? Ignorance is a condition for choices. Choices are a condition for consciousness. Consciousness is a condition for name and form. Name and form are conditions for the six sense fields. The six sense fields are a condition for our conditions for contact. Contact is a condition for feeling. Feeling is a condition for craving. Craving is a condition for grasping. Grasping is a condition for existence. Continued existence is a condition for rebirth. Rebirth is a condition for old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and distress, and to come to be. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. This is called dependent origination. So that is the statement of dependent origination. And for those of you who have never seen this before, you probably wonder, what on earth? This is very strange. What is going on here? What is all this stuff about name and form and grasping being a condition for existence? What is this all about? The six sense field, the contact, and all of these things. But first time you see this, you wonder, this sounds really strange and very, very funny. But remember, this is a very compacted idea of dependent origination. So the idea now is to unpack this and to pull it apart and to show you that actually this makes a lot of sense once you understand what is going on here. On the surface, it seems very kind of cryptic, and it seems like something which is very hard to understand, but actually, it is not that hard to understand, it's just very condensed. Now, the first thing to notice here is that we were just talking before about the second noble truth, how craving tanha is a condition for rebirth, and right there you have craving in the middle there, and it shows you that craving goes is a condition for grasping, and grasping to continued existence to rebirth. Yeah? So right there it is. But the nice thing about dependent origination, it doesn't stop with craving. It actually shows you the causes for craving and takes the causes of craving all the way back to the root cause. And the root cause here is avijja, which is ignorance or illusion or wrong view or lack of understanding or reality or whatever you want to call it. That is the root problem. And that matters. Why does that matter? Well, it matters enormously because craving is something we cannot necessarily do anything about. You can maybe reduce your craving by having sense restraint, by being wise in how you live, by having mindfulness when you live, so you can reduce your cravings. But eliminating craving cannot be eliminated by sense restraint and mindfulness. That is not enough. All that can do is to reduce it down. And you know what I mean? Yeah, well, sometimes you become very mindful, there is no desire, there is no craving there. You're able to restrain yourself, you see some delicious food, and you think, okay, not now. It's difficult to restrain yourself when you see delicious food, and sometimes when you get really mindful, you can do that. Yeah? So, because craving cannot be overcome merely by mindfulness, this is one of those great, another misunderstanding in Buddhism, mindfulness is not enough. It is very useful to know what is the causes of craving. And the core, root cause, is delusion or lack of understanding. Yeah? Not seeing things according to reality. Now, I pointed out before that we already know the solution to that. We know the solution to that because we're saying before, if you want to see things according to reality, you need samadhi. Yeah? So the solution to this problem of avijja, there is a solution to this. Avijja can be overturned, ignorance can be eliminated, delusion can become into clarity, clear seeing, through deep meditation practice, through samadhi specifically. So it is impossible to overcome craving fully, just by focusing on craving, but it is possible to eliminate delusion through meditation practice. And this is why it is such a powerful thing to see the whole sequence of dependent origination. That is where the solution comes into view. What it is that we have to do to eliminate the problem of craving and then suffering with it. Yeah? You agree? Yeah, maybe? makes a little sense, right? It's not, it's sort of, you know, this is, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, please try again this evening with some questions. I'm trying to make it clear, but sometimes it's clear to me, but everyone else is kind of in the fog. And I know what it's like sometimes. So, because I've been doing this for 25 years, after a while we forget how stupid I was at the beginning. Yeah? We're all stupid at the beginning. Yeah? So, avidya is the problem, and there is a solution to overcome avidya, ignorance and illusion and wrong understanding. That's called meditation, specifically deep, deep meditation, known as samadhi, and jhana is really the solution to this. And that is, of course, the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah? The Noble Eightfold Path ends with samadhi, with the four jhanas. Now you know why it ends with that, because that is the point where you eliminate delusion and you see things according to reality. Yeah? So what is this avidya? I want to focus a little bit now on this idea of avidya. And to understand what avidya is, there is a next sutra here, it's called analysis. Yeah? Vibhanga is the Pali word for analysis, and so we'll turn over one page, and I will. This kind of gives you definitions of all of these various terms, yeah. But except that it gives them in reverse order, so you have to go to the very bottom of the sutra. At the very bottom there, it says, "What is ignorance? What is avidya?" Did you see that? At the very end of that sutra, and it says, "Not knowing about suffering, not knowing suffering, not knowing the origin of suffering, not knowing the end of suffering, not knowing the practice that leads to the end of suffering." This is called avidya. This is called delusion or ignorance or lack of understanding. So interesting, it is the Four Noble Truths, and we don't know. Yeah, this is the problem. This is why we are studying the Four Noble Truths right now. Because the more you understand them, the less delusion you have. So this is the root problem at the kind of the root of suffering and why it is problematic. Now, to get what dependent origination is saying is avidya leads to choices. Choices here, the word is sankhara. Sankhara can be translated as the will, intentions, choices, all the activity, yeah, all the actions that we do inside, whenever we make a choice, I'm going to do this. This is sankhara, the doing, the agent inside, this is sankhara. So what we want to understand here is a connection between ignorance and doing. Why is it that when you are ignorant, you do, you act, you become an agent, you have all this will? What is going on here? So to understand this, we have to look at avidya in a particular way. So one of the avidya is not understanding the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, this is the kind of delusion. The first of those Four Noble Truths is dukkha, so it means that not understanding suffering. And with suffering always comes the three characteristics of existence, the tilakkhana. Yeah? These are suffering, impermanence, and non-self. These are called the three characteristics of existence in Buddhism. Tilakkhana, I call it Pali. And these are kind of the main types of insight that you have into existence when you have insight after a deep meditation. This is what you see. You see the emptiness of things. There's no self there. You see impermanence and you see dukkha. Yeah? And all of these are very closely related to each other. If things are impermanent, they are suffering. Why? Well, because we hold on to things and then they change. No, it's changing. I want to have this. I want to have my relationship. I want to have this. I want to have that. But change is always suffering for human beings because we attach to things. So impermanence and suffering are very closely related to each other. Non-self, also very closely related. Because the fact that things are impermanent, that is what makes them non-self. So when we talk about the first noble truth of suffering, in a way we're talking about all three of these lakkhanas together, the three characteristics of existence, suffering, impermanent suffering, and non-self. So we start with that as our starting point. So avidya, what that means is that we don't understand impermanence. We think somehow that things are more permanent than they really are, yeah? That's why you grieve when your relationship breaks up, because you think, oh no, it was supposed to last. No, it wasn't supposed to last, it was impermanent. The Buddha said so. And impermanent means impermanent at any moment, any time, bang, it's finished. That is the problem. That is why life sometimes can be so traumatic and difficult. The problem is we take things to be more permanent than they actually are. We see an essence inside of ourselves, a soul. This is why the idea of soul is so common in the world, in Christianity, in Hinduism, in Islam. Almost all religions have an idea of a soul, an essence, an inherent essence inside of us. Yeah? And because that's how it feels like, yeah, the real me. And what is the real me? You can't really put a finger on it, but you know, you feel it somehow, there's a real me inside there. So this is how this comes about. So things are, we take things to be more permanent than they actually are. This is the delusion of human beings. We take things to be happy, which actually are suffering. Yeah? We look for happiness in the wrong place in the world. We look for happiness in suffering, but we don't understand where true happiness is to be found. And we take things that are inherently empty, that there's nothing there, it's just a permanent phenomenon, we take that to be a permanent self. So these are the three things where we go wrong. And once you have that wrong view of the world, these are called vipalasa. Vipalasa means a distortion of reality, the inversion of reality. You see things in the exact opposite way of what they are. I mentioned before the noble ones, but noble ones take to be suffering. Ordinary people take to be happiness. Yeah, but the ordinary people take to be happiness, the noble ones take to be suffering. So it's almost an exact inversion of reality. So because we think happiness is to be found in the world, we think happiness is to be found in relationships. Yay, a new relationship, hooray. Oh no, it's ended. Another one. Okay, another relationship, yeah? Now after doing this a million times, we still haven't got it. We still keep on looking for that happiness in those relationships. And then you get a bit of happiness out of it, and then you think that down the track you will find a real relationship that is going to last or whatever. So we look for happiness in relationships. We look for happiness in the pleasures of the world, you know, all the various pleasures around the world, forgetting how incredibly unreliable all of that is and how hollow it is. And because we think that the happiness is out there to be had, if we just run around in the world enough, we will get this happiness. This becomes the driving force that makes us act. And you act because you seek the happiness in the world. And the happiness is out there, so you have to do something to get it. Yeah? And this is how there is a connection between your ignorance or delusion about where happiness is to be found and your agency inside, your activity, all of this activity comes about because you're looking for happiness in the wrong place. This is one part of it. There's another part to this, and that is this feeling that we are agents in our lives, the feeling that we have the capacity to make things happen. This is what agency feels like. If I just do the right thing, then things will happen in my life in the right way. All I have to do is kind of, you know, be nice and kind and be friendly and be and kind of work hard enough and whatever else it is, and then you know, things will kind of fall into place. We have a feeling of agency, that we are doers in the world, that we can affect phenomena in the world, so that we can hold on to things, grasp things, be attached to things, own things, so that we can become the owner of things in the world. But this is a delusion. Yeah, this idea that we have this all this agency, that we can control things in the world, is actually an illusion. And the more we look at the world, yeah, one of the reasons why you get upset when there are so many problems in Hong Kong is because we have the illusion that things should be like this, it should be different. Yeah, we should be in control of the situation. We are not in control of the situation. This is the whole point. If things are really out of control, we have no idea what's going to happen next. The riots you have now, or the protests you have now, these are just a small thing compared to what could really happen. It's nothing. Yes, this might just be the beginning of something much worse. Who knows what's going to happen down the track? I'm not making any predictions. I'm just saying it is uncertain. That's all I'm saying. So the point is that we, the problem is the illusion inside that we are in control. And for that reason, we think that certain outcomes should happen. There should be certain results. There should be certain things that should happen as a consequence of that. But that sense itself is an illusion. And because we identify with that, because we think that we are the doer in the world, not only is there an illusion of control, but we also enjoy the doing. Because if you identify as the doer, if you are the doer in the world, it means that whatever you do, you are satisfied that feeling of being the doer. Have you ever felt that before? When you do something, you feel like you are the agent, you feel like you're creating something. Yeah, I'm the creator. I'm creating something. If you're an artist, you create a beautiful work of art. If you work hard in your job, you create something, you make something out of your job. If you work hard in meditation, you make something out of your meditation practice. Are you sure? Maybe that's the wrong. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe you should make something out of your meditation practice. That's kind of where the problem arises. This is why we should allow meditation to happen, rather than continue that creation in meditation. So we gratify the sense of doing. Yeah, you feel like you are alive. If you identify with the doer and then you act, it feels like you are alive because you're gratifying the doer inside us. So whenever you act, it means that you feel alive because you identify with that. Yeah, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? So whenever you enjoy doing something, you are doing something nice, and you think, yeah, I did this, I made this. So, yeah, well done, you did all this. Wow, you are such a genius, you are so creative. Yeah, and you think, yeah, that's right, I'm really creative. I'm really creative. And then you feel gratified. The doer inside feels gratified. So this is how it works, and this is why we are agents in this world, and why we act, why we make all these choices. This is the connection between avidya and sankhara, between delusion and choosing. So the problem with this is that sometimes in the world you think that there is happiness to be had out there, sometimes other people get in the way of your happiness. Yeah, sometimes other people say bad things to you. Sometimes other people are chasing the same partner that you want. So if another person is chasing the same partner that you want, if you are a ruthless individual, you will somehow try to get rid of them. And even if you have to be a bit nasty, you will get rid of them. Why? Because the other person is standing in the way of your happiness. After all, you know that that happiness is in that relationship. Yeah? So because you know that, it's what you think you know anyway, because you know that you have to have that relationship and the other person is standing in the way. So you do something to be ruthless, do something to do something wrong. Or you think that you need this promotion in your job, it's all about status. Yeah, I need this promotion, I need to have a salary increase. So you are ruthless with your colleagues, yeah? Maybe you lie a little bit, or you are harsh towards them, or whatever it is, make sure you put them on so you can have that promotion. I think that's the wrong way to go about promotion. Anyway, if you want a promotion, I think that's a silly way of doing it. But some people are like that. They're harsh, they're ruthless, and they don't live with kindness because they want to get on in the world. Or you find a good excuse for not paying your taxes. Yeah, you think, yeah, actually, now I have a really good excuse because like someone was saying yesterday, my taxes just go to the police. Yeah, the police are being violent, so actually, I have a good grounds for not paying my taxes. Yeah. So you think, yeah, how can I get out of paying my taxes? Okay. And and this is just one example, but very many people in the world, they find it's a kind of sport in trying to get out of having to pay your taxes. And this is very, very common. And in Europe, there's always that, Europe is a very divided continent, lots of different cultures, but tiny little place. And there's kind of the Italians in Europe, they're famous for not paying their taxes in Europe. You always make fun of the Italians. Because Italian is not a country where you're not supposed to pay your taxes, you're supposed to kind of get out of it. But all of these things are driven by this feeling that you are, there is happiness to be had in the world. And if you just cheat a little bit, if you live immorally, then you can have that happiness. And this is how immorality comes into this equation. You look for happiness in the wrong place. And when you look for happiness in the wrong place, you will do immoral things to get that happiness. Sometimes you will do moral things, because sometimes moral things happen to coincide with the happiness. And then you are moral and you live well. Yeah, if you have a nice partner, you are kind to your partner because you know that is how that relationship will last. If you are nice with your partner, the relationship is likely to break up very quickly. Yeah. So you are nice. In that case, morality coincides with happiness. So you do bad acts, you do good acts. Yeah? This is how you make karma based on delusion. This is how karma comes about. These samkaras, these choices, this is the karma that you're making. Now good karma, now bad karma. And as we do this, as I was saying yesterday, as we make all of these karmas, they affect our mind. How you feel about yourself is directly related to your intentions. So if you make good choices, if you are kind to others, you feel good about yourself. Yeah, we all know that you feel good about yourself when you're kind to other people. And if you're nasty to other people, you don't feel good about yourself. In fact, you feel a bit bad about yourself. You may be in denial about it, but if you're honest about yourself, you really feel what's going on. You will feel that being unkind, actually feels bad. So, well, by making all of these choices, we are affecting our consciousness. This is the third factor of dependent origination, vijnana. Yeah, so you do good acts, you do bad acts. You are affecting your consciousness by these good and bad acts. If you do a lot of good acts, your consciousness becomes bright and light and beautiful. It makes the consciousness better, if you like. If you do lots of bad acts, it affects your consciousness in a bad way. It makes your mind dark, and a dark and negative and unpleasant and heavy place, etc. Connection between avijja, sankhara, and vijnana. Delusion, activities, yeah, and then consciousness. Consciousness means the mind, yeah, here in this case. This is how it works. And then one day you think, yeah, you know, maybe this world isn't as great, or that maybe I should become a bit more spiritual, maybe I should go to that Kaduri retreat, yeah? Now you're here, because you fall down, now that's why you're here now, yeah? You thought, wow, maybe I should go there and kind of try to look at life in a different way. You know, once you start becoming a Buddhist, once you start to become more spiritual, the avijja, the delusion, goes down a little bit. We are reducing delusion because you understand that maybe there isn't quite as much happiness in the world as I thought there was. Sometimes you need a bit of experience. Sometimes you see it is kind of people over 50 that come on retreats. The ones under 50 are much more rare because it takes a bit of life experience sometimes to kind of get it that there is a problem here. Yeah? For people, at least over a certain age. So I'm always very impressed when people come in their 20s, especially, it means, wow, they really have understood something in that life. So you look at things in a new way. Yeah, you start to realize, actually, there is some limit to this world. Maybe there is something to be had in kindness. You start to understand this idea of kindness, of morality, of avoiding what is doing bad. And because you understand that your choices change, you start to choose more wisely. Instead of becoming upset by trivial things in the world, you let them go. You don't worry about those trivial things in the world, and you focus more on kindness instead. If your partner in life wants to run off with someone else, you say, yeah, okay, run off with someone else. That's really high. Yeah, that's really kind of a bit, you almost have to be sane to be able to do that. But that's kind of where it's heading, yeah? And if there's small little things in life, you don't get the promotion in your work, you don't get the pay rise, you shrug your shoulders. It doesn't make much difference anyway for how happy you feel. It's kind of irrelevant. And then instead, you focus on kindness. You're not so competitive anymore. You don't put other people down. You don't cheat other people. You don't lie because you want to get your way. Instead, you understand these things are dangerous. In the long term, these reduce happiness rather than increase it. And so, because you have less delusion, because you have more understanding of life, and everyone here, you may not believe it, but it's true, you already have quite a bit of understanding, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Yeah. Maybe you feel that you're not so wise, but you have a little bit of wisdom. What a wonderful thing that is. Yeah, and less delusion, better choices. It means your consciousness becomes more bright and more pure. You're lifting up your consciousness. It becomes more pleasant to live, more pleasant to exist, because inside of yourself you are a better, purer, brighter, happier person. And then you continue with doing this, and as delusion, the avijja at the beginning becomes even less, there comes a point when you start to understand that actually all this doing itself is really the problem. When I meditate and I become peaceful, actually the activity, the very act of doing is problematic. It is far better to be completely peaceful and blissed out than to do all of this activity in the world. This is a new level of non-delusion, whereby you understand that the peace of meditation practice, not doing anything at all, is actually far superior to doing it. This is where you are on this path towards cessation and ending of things. Because now you are you're actually making less choices. Sankhara is starting to die down. And in the process of sankhara dying down, first of all, you make incredibly powerful good karma by entering deep states of meditation. But ultimately, you don't make any karma at all anymore. And the process starts to stop instead. So you make consciousness brighter and brighter and brighter. Yeah, better and better and better, lifting it up more and more, until eventually the whole thing actually stops in there. So this is how this process works. You eliminate illusion, you start to understand where true happiness is to be found. Real happiness is to be found not in making activities, not in making the world happen in your way, but stopping all kind of creativity, all kind of action. That is where real happiness is to be found. Yeah, and then you eliminate that. You see, deep inside, Avijja sees that there is no doer. You are not the doer. You are not the agent. Agency is a conditioned process. The reason why you like Chinese food is because you're born in Hong Kong. The reason why I like Norwegian food, every morning, Gerald serves me salmon. Yeah, salmon is like Norwegian food. Yeah, he serves me salmon. So because I'm Norwegian, I'm conditioned to like Norwegian food. Actually, I like quite like Chinese food as well. Maybe I was Chinese in the past life, but you know, anyway, yeah, we tend to be conditioned in a certain way. You think you're making a choice. Yeah, I choose noodles because I like noodles. Actually, no, you choose noodles because you're born in Hong Kong. That's why you choose noodles. You're conditioned in this way. Because Sri Lankan, you choose dal. Yeah, because that's what Sri Lankans eat. Actually, I like dal too. I was probably born in Sri Lanka as well. So the more you look at this, you understand, this is all conditioned. I'm not making any real choices anyway, so why am I so concerned about making choices in the world? Just silly choices, don't lead me anywhere. Much better not to make any choices at all, and just become peaceful in my meditation practice. This is how this conditioned process works. This is how, from avidya, if you have a lot of ignorance, your mind becomes dark and unpleasant. The less ignorance you have, the brighter and more beautiful your mind becomes. This is the direct link between the ignorance you have and how you feel about yourself. This is why we try to undermine ignorance. Why we try to become wiser in this world, to have more clarity about things, because then you start to feel happier as a consequence. So, what happens when the mind brightens up in this way, when you live in the right way? Say that you are the opposite, you are really deluded, so you make your mind really dark, you do bad things, yeah? You get reborn in a triad, gangster family here in... Are there many triads? Yeah, triads in Hong Kong, okay. Anyone here? Triad? Okay, I'm pretty careful what I say, if they're here, so, okay, I'm okay. But if you are reborn in a kind of triad or a mafia family, yeah, you almost have to do bad things because it's a requirement that you are part of these things if you become reborn in these families, yeah? You have no choice in the matter. So you do dark things, you drag yourself down, and you end up in a very, very bad place after a while. So what happens is that as the consciousness either is lifted up and made brighter, or it's dragged down and made darker, or it kind of stays maybe on the same level. All of these are possibilities. As you do that, when you die, yeah, when you come to the end of your life, your consciousness will have a certain level. Yeah, a general level. Of course, consciousness oscillates a bit in daily life, but there will be a general level that you come back to, which is your general state of consciousness and mind. When you die, your consciousness will be at a particular level. That is where you continue in your future life. This is how rebirth happens, according to your karma. Your karma is the brightness of the consciousness that you take with you into the future. So when you die, the consciousness has a certain brightness, you continue at that level. In a sense, you have already built up that rebirth, that new realm is already built up inside of you in this life. And when you pass away, you just continue there. Yeah? This is how rebirth happens, because you already have built up a consciousness according to a certain level. Most people, they kind of just bump along in life, and then when they die, they are roughly where they kind of started out, yeah? And then you look back and think, it's also pointless. What was the point of this life? What have we been doing? We've been living, doing all of these things. Now we have to die. Your life seems empty and pointless because nothing has really happened from the moment you were born to the moment you died. But if you live a spiritual life, if you lift your mind up and you realize you're going to be reborn in a better place than where you started out, you actually feel you're making real spiritual progress. You're going somewhere. And then when you die, you rejoice in having lived well, and having taken yourself somewhere. Not only do you get reborn in a better place, but you're also on your way, ultimately, if you keep on doing this, ultimately, all the way to the end of all of this rebirth business, to nirvana, in other words, yeah, the highest happiness that is experienceable for human beings. Anyone want the highest happiness? Yeah? Everybody wants the highest happiness. Why not? If it is there, why does one have it? Yeah? There's no point in kind of going without suffering if you can't have the highest happiness. This is what is so attractive about this. And then, when you get reborn, then wherever it is that you get reborn, you will have certain experiences. If you get reborn in the human realm, you will tend to have human experiences. Yeah, human experiences have a certain range. It can be very, really, really bad. You get reborn in a very poor country, no education, stupid, sickly, all these things. Or you can be reborn like really nicely, yeah? Everything is kind of right, well off, reasonably intelligent, yeah? You kind of don't have much illnesses, all of these kind of things. So there's a certain range of experience that we have as human beings. But if you get reborn in a heavenly Devaloka, the range of experience you have is different. You feel more happiness, you feel more powerful, your experiences are different. This is what we mean by nama rupa, name and form. Name and form is about the range of experience that you can have wherever you get reborn. If you get reborn as an animal, yeah, as a mosquito or something, if you get reborn as a mosquito, it's very hard to imagine being reborn as a mosquito, but if you get your range of experience is very, very different from human again. They're much darker, much more unpleasant. People kind of just squash you at any kind of moment because they don't want to not like mosquitoes, etc. So the range of experience we have depends entirely on where you get reborn. This is the idea of nama rupa. Yeah? The factor which comes after vijnana. Vijnana is the condition for nama rupa. Okay, I think we should have a break, yeah? Because otherwise I'm going to explode your brain very soon. So let's have a break now, and 10 minutes, and we'll come back again after that, 10:30, and then we can continue this. Do you have a question, or we can do questions maybe this evening, otherwise it can get too complicated. Okay, great.